Any agreement short of that, it seems to me he's not going to go for.
And in fact, on NATO, which of course many speculated that this was indeed the reason that Russia invaded Ukraine, it's not only that the plan calls for an end to NATO expansion, but it says specifically, singling out Ukraine, that Ukraine should inscribe in its constitution that it will not join NATO, and that NATO would include in its statutes a provision that Ukraine will not be admitted. If you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that really just goes way, way too far. I think there are commitments that could be made, assurances that could be made with regard to Ukraine and NATO. But again, I do not think that NATO and Ukraine's possibility or impossibility of joining NATO is really the issue here. It is one among a whole set of issues that indicate Ukraine's ultimate orientation and its ultimate independence. Ukraine's independence is the real issue here, as far as I can tell.
And the plan also says that all parties to the conflict, I mean, Ukraine and Russia, will receive full amnesty once the proposal goes into effect, the ceasefire, if indeed that's what it is, the peace plan, which seems, some have said, in part geared towards having the ICC warrant against Putin lifted and also absolving Russia of alleged war crimes, including what happened in Bucha. If you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really objectionable. But, you know, again, as hard as it is to say, if that's something that gets us to an end to the war, a durable end to the war, that is something that we should consider. This is certainly not justice for the many, many victims of Russia's violence, which has been grotesque. Unfortunately, the United States itself is not in a great position here, given the cover that we continue to give to partners like Israel for their war crimes in Gaza, clearly war crimes. So I think the United States and its allies in Europe would be in a much better position to push back against this if we were applying these standards equally, which we are not.
And Matt, does the significance of the corruption scandal that's been engulfing the Zelensky administration with his number two man, Andriy Yermak, the chief of staff, to Zelensky being forced out, you usually always see him at his side?
Yeah, no, I think this has been a corruption scandal that has been brewing for a while. And the firing of Zelensky's number two man, his chief of staff, is obviously very significant. Ukraine continues to struggle with corruption problems that go back a long time. But I also think it's worth noting the fact that the number two leader in Ukraine was removed from power because of a corruption investigation is itself a very, very positive step.
And finally, Matt, if you could comment on the sheer scale of the destruction that this war has wrought, not only in terms of, you know, entire areas in Ukraine being flattened, but also that Russia has suffered over 600,000 casualties, that is to say, people killed and wounded. This is roughly 10 times the number of Soviet casualties suffered over a decade in their invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. And open source data has revealed that 111,000 Russian military personnel have been killed. Meanwhile, also open source data shows that there have been about 400,000 Ukrainian casualties. And Zelensky himself has said that 43,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed. So if you could talk about this, I mean, this is a really extraordinary, these are extraordinary numbers.
It is extraordinary, and it's just a staggering waste. I mean, for what? For what did these people die? For what reason were they sent into this horrible meat grinder? For what was this destruction done? To take some land in eastern Ukraine? I think this is, again, as horrible as this is, and as horrible it is to consider the fact that there might have to be some form of amnesty, I do also think it's worth noting that Vladimir Putin, after nearly 4 years of war, has not achieved anything close to his ultimate goal. And I do think this is worth considering as we talk about the possibility of a ceasefire. Ukraine has performed far, has done greater things than I think anyone expected. So given the loss of life, given the destruction, I know it's hard for many Ukrainians to consider having to make some concessions to end the war. But I do think there is a victory narrative here for Ukraine to take. One other thing I do want to mention in terms of the costs of this war is the tens of thousands of Ukrainian children that were taken into Russia and distributed among Russian families. That is absolutely something we should not forget. That is something on which there should be no compromise. These children need to be returned to their families.
And what does the plan say about that, the proposal that the U.S. has put forth?
I'm unclear what it says on that. This is something that's clearly going to be contested as we get if we get into anything close to final status talks, which it doesn't seem like we're close to right now.
Matt Doss, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy and former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, President Trump says he's going to limit immigration from, quote, the third world. We'll be back to talk about this and what's happening here in New York City. ICE raids that have been thwarted by activists blocking ICE cars. Stay with us. Musician Khaira Arbis is performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We look now at the escalating crackdown on lawful immigration pathways as the Trump administration has announced it's pausing green card and U.S. citizenship processing for immigrants from 19 non-European countries that were already subject to a travel ban put in place earlier this year. This comes as federal immigration agents have reportedly begun operations targeting the Somali community in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. The Trump administration's announcements has also paused all asylum decisions for immigrants currently in the U.S. after an Afghan national was charged with murdering a National Guard member and critically injuring another in Washington, D.C. last week. He's pleaded not guilty.
For more, we're joined by Murad Awalda, a president and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, part of Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's Committee on Immigrant Justice. In a moment, we're going to ask you about what's happened here in New York with attempted ICE raids thwarted by the community. But first, let's talk about exactly what President Trump is talking about when he says he's going to stop immigration from the, quote, third world. And what real life effects is this having?
So Donald Trump has made several horrendous allegations against immigrant communities, especially in the wake of the unfortunate and devastating incident in D.C., where he is saying now that they are going to be pausing all asylum applications and reviewing those who have been approved under the previous administration as well. The problem with that is that asylum and refugee status are some of the most the hardest statuses to attain. The amount of vetting that you have to go through is insane in itself, but also it's a very diligent process. So for them to say that they're pausing all asylum claims, that they're going to be reviewing all refugees who've come into this country, and now saying that they're going to pause and in essence ban all black, brown, and anyone who isn't white from coming into the United States, just as another slap in the face of the communities that continue to make this country move forward, the economic engine, the heartbeat of this nation. So what we're going to see is millions of families who have been waiting, following the process, following the law to the letter of it, who are waiting for their families to be reunited with them here, pretty much having to be left in limbo, not knowing if they're ever going to get connected with each other again.
And do you know, like, on what grounds, I mean, apart from just a presidential whim, has he, first of all, chosen those 19 countries? And, you know, has anything like this ever happened here before, like an outright suspension of a consideration of these applications?
There has been under Trump 1.0.
Yes, of course.
He did this almost immediately after coming into office. It was sued several times. And in essence, what happened was the ban was in part struck down, but then also upheld by the Supreme Court because saying that the executive had the power to do so. This is different, though. They're doing this along a different route where they're trying to say that this is going to be a temporary measure to ensure that they are, quote unquote, fully vetting individuals who are coming into this nation.
And people are already reporting that they've appeared for green card interviews and U.S. citizenship ceremonies, and they've been turned away without explanation. They didn't even know that their appointments were canceled. What kind of recourse do people have now? I mean, this is an extraordinary move.
This is really, imagine going through a process that can take up to 10, 15, 20 years. And then at the very end, when you are about to become a naturalized U.S. citizen who has contributed to this nation, who has continued to build your family here, built your life here for decades, and then at the last second being told, get out of the line, you're not allowed to get naturalized today. Or even families who've waited forever to actually get their appointment to have their family come in for a green card interview, and either being rejected and saying your appointment has been canceled, or that the person is getting detained and being put through deportation proceedings, which is also happening.
And even to get a green card, as indeed someone who's gone through the process, there is an extraordinary amount of vetting that takes place, an extraordinary amount of paperwork. And after that vetting, it takes 5 years to get citizenship. Like, what more vetting is even possible to do?
It's just, you know, lunacy at this point of the excuses that they keep coming up with when we know what they're trying to do. This has never been about vetting. This has never been about security and safety. It's about cruelty, and that's their point. And they'll continue to lean in on their cruelty, and we have to continue to fight back.
I wanted to just name those countries, 19 countries, that they are stopping processing for. And they're already talking about adding a number of other countries to this: Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela.
Yeah, these are similar countries that he tried initially putting the full ban, the partial ban, and then more restrictions on when he first came into office, and saying that he was going to do the same that he did the last time around. So this is sort of using the same trick out of the same toolbox of trying to just harm more communities across this country.
And if there were any doubt about what the actual intention of the Trump administration appears to be, he's actually said specifically that the U.S. should welcome more people from countries like Norway, Denmark, and Switzerland, in addition to, of course, his special fondness for Afrikaners in South Africa, from South Africa.
Well, we don't have to guess why he's saying this. He wants to make, and his entire anti-immigrant platform, his war on immigrants, and his mass deportation agenda is all to lead to making America white again.
Exactly.
And that is what it comes down to.
So let's talk about the resistance. Here in New York, on Saturday, police arrested a number of protesters after people blocked the exit of a parking garage in Lower Manhattan where federal agents were staging before an immigration raid targeting street vendors from West Africa, similar to a raid in October on Canal Street. This weekend, Time magazine ran a headline that read how 200 New Yorkers foiled an ICE raid before it even began. You got there soon after this whole thing was happening. Murad, your staff was there. Can you talk about what took place? And also, I mean, New York City is a sanctuary city. Police did make arrests, about a dozen people. Are they cooperating with the ICE agents?
So last Saturday, you had over several dozen ICE agents who had been congregating in this garage facility. And I think people don't realize how big and small New York City is. We are a city of 9 million people. We are across 300 square miles. And, you know, it is very hard not to be noticed, especially when you are about to do something that people in the city do not welcome. Several people witnessed this, became several dozens after they put out the call, and then several hundred showed up to push back against them. And in essence, these New Yorkers thwarted this and foiled this plot that they had of doing this mass theatrics on Canal Street yet again. The problem with that is that when the protesters did arrive, what you ended up seeing was NYPD coming in to provide cover for ICE. And the way in which NYPD is reporting it is that they were doing crowd control and helping get them, quote unquote, out of the parking lot so they can be on their way. There's a very slippery slope here where they're operating in a gray area where they did collude with ICE, even if it was for the crowd control in that moment. But what does that mean for the future? What does that mean when NYPD shows up to ICE raid, which has been happening across the city since the inception of this administration for the past 11 months? Just this morning in Jackson Heights, there was a massive raid. So what does it mean when you're having these instances where New Yorkers are going to stand up and nonviolently defend their community?
Let's turn to a story right here, not far from Democracy Now! Studios, as New Yorkers protest escalating ICE raids in the city. Some are also volunteering to support newly arrived migrants and asylum seekers, including those from West Africa. I want to turn to a report by Democracy Now!'s Messiah Rhodes.
We're here in front of Plateau, where Cafe Wall Weekday Kitchen provides over 150 meals a day, with its origins in supporting West African migrants escaping political oppression and violence from their home country, as well as the violence of granolism as they journey to the United States. Cafe Wall provides a warm meal and a safe haven for West African migrants just newly arriving in New York City.
So my name is Tyler Heffron. I'm the executive director of EV Loves NYC. We are a organization founded back in 2020 with a mission to fight food insecurity all over New York City. In our third year of operations, we started to work with a lot of refugee and asylum seeker populations coming through the city-run St. Bridget's Migrant Reticketing Center in the East Village. And at that point, we began to meet a lot of asylum seekers from West Africa who were coming over as single adults to seek asylum from their respective countries. So from there, what we started to do is we opened a volunteer program focused on asylum seekers to get them the letters they needed to stay in the New York City shelter system. That began in Ramadan of 2024, where we invited the handful of people that we had been meeting on a close basis to come into our kitchen and prepare authentic West African meals. They just sent us the ingredients. They knew all the recipes by heart, and it was some of their favorite childhood dishes from back home. So it was a really fun week where every night we would prepare a iftar meal for a different mosque or community organization serving hundreds of New Yorkers who were observing fasting during Ramadan. And that sort of began this impromptu restaurant training program. About 6 months later, we founded a full-time kitchen called Cafe Wall, which means cafeteria in the Fulani language. That's developed to a fuller-scale workforce training program, where the hope is that the people that are getting paid wages to work in our kitchen are getting ready ready for, to work in some of your favorite restaurants around New York City. So we work with different mutual aids, like East Village Neighbors Who Care, to help them with the different supporting services, like English lessons, resume writing, job applications, all those different supports that we take for granted here as citizens, in addition to the workforce training that they're receiving in the kitchen every day.
My name is Abdul Karim. I'm from Guinea. I have been in Cafe Wall 7 months. I'm cooking here rice and the chicken, the salad, the potato.
What future do you see in the United States?
I'm not to come here for looking for money and something. I'm come here for help the people here. When I help the people here, the people will help me one day.
Hey, I'm Jamie Ba. Oh yeah, it was back in January 2024. I was just trying to find a place where it's warm, because it was cold at that time. So at Tompkins Park, they told me about Earth Church. It was a warming center for everyone. So I went there, and you know, I see how the East Village Neighbors Who Care was taking care of the guys. So I was very impressed, and then I proposed myself to be volunteer.
Can you talk about the role of interpreters, how interpreters are a part of Cafe Wall when it comes to the language barrier?
Oh yeah, for the interpreter, it's a the good thing, because a lot of guys here, they didn't go to school, they just speak Fulani, and it's very difficult for them to speak English, so they are very confident to see the guys from their country and speaking their own languages, and to be an interpreter, they are very confident and comfortable to talk about their problem, even it's very privacy, so they do a lot of jobs here. So I'm so happy to have them alongside me to help and to continue to run Cafe Wall.
My name is Brian Duggan. I'm an attorney, and I volunteer for not-for-profit organizations like Cafe Wall, and also provide low bono services for and pro bono services for some of the asylees here.
Why is it harder for West African migrants to find legal representation compared to others?
Yeah, it's very difficult because of the language barriers in a lot of ways, but also because the system itself is so swamped with people applying for asylum, and there's a low capacity for legal support, and a lot of attorneys require a lot of money up front, which these people are unable to provide. So they rely on a lot of people to provide pro bono services, pro se services, which are self-help type services, and attorneys such as myself who try to provide low-cost services for them so they could at least have some support at the hearings.
And in what countries do you commonly see people come from, and where are they usually escaping from that you've seen?
The countries I've been associated with mostly are West Africans. Mm-hmm. Guinea is one of them, Morocco, and also Mauritania. Those three areas have a lot of issues with their government, especially Guinea and Mauritania. They have government control, and most of the asylees here are refugees as ethnic refugees, because they belong to an ethnic group called the Fulani, who have been persecuted by the powers in that are comprised of another ethnic group, the Malinke. And so historically, since France left Guinea, the government's been occupied by one dictator after another, and they've always persecuted the Fulani. The Fulani make up the largest population, but they're usually the targets of most of the violence. The government treats them and persecutes them with impunity. They beat them regularly. They have what they call enforced disappearances, where they are taken away from their homes and the families don't know where they are, and usually have no opportunities to reclaim their bodies after they've found out that they were dead. This goes on all the time, and there is no recourse. Doesn't seem to be any kind of pressure for this to abate. So this results in a lot of refugees coming to the United States.
Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Messiah Rhodes, Safwat Nazal, and Robby Karen for that report. On Tuesday, I got a chance to ask New York Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani about protecting workers from ICE.
Can I ask a question about many of the workers in this city are immigrants? When you met with President Trump, did you get a concession from him around ICE raids and not moving into the city?
When I met with the president, I made very clear that these kinds of raids are cruel and inhumane, that they are raids that do nothing to serve the interests of public safety, and that my responsibility is to be the mayor to each and every person that calls this city their home. And that includes millions of immigrants, of which I am one. And I am proud that I will be the first immigrant mayor of this city in generations, and prouder still for the fact that I will live up to the statue that we have in our harbor and the ideals which we have long proclaimed as being those of this city, but which have too often been ones we do not actually enforce and celebrate on a daily basis. And that is who I will be as the mayor of this city.
That's Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani standing with Senator Bernie Sanders. They were walking the picket line with Starbucks workers, who are also going to stage another protest today at 1 o'clock in front of the Empire State Building. Murad Awalda, you are serving on the transition team of the mayor-elect and the mayor. You'll be advising him. As you listen to that report of groups that are serving the West African community, and this whole question of how the city will be working with or against the president when it comes to ICE raids. What kind of protection do people have, and what can Mayor Mamdani do?
Well, the first thing is having a mayor who's actually going to stand up and fight for New Yorkers is an amazing feat to have in this moment. The other piece is that we already have numerous sanctuary policies on the books, which the current administration has been running afoul in, which DOI, the Department of Investigation, released yesterday a report of several incidences where they had to investigate and saw that there was some efforts of collusion from pro-Palestine activists to an NYPD officer going rogue and assisting ICE agents. So we want to make sure that anyone who's working for the city of New York is abiding by local laws, including NYPD, DOC, and all city agencies. So an audit of every agency and their communication is absolutely necessary. And then training workers to be able to understand that your job is not to harm and, you know, contribute to family separation or hurting our communities and our city, but it's to actually uplift all New Yorkers. Additionally, investing in immigration legal services. You heard the lawyer from EV Loves New York City, which is an amazing member organization of ours that serves thousands of people every year. A big issue is that we don't have enough immigration lawyers, and we need additional immigration legal services funding from the city of New York. So making sure that we're following the laws that we currently have on the books, expanding where we can, and then making sure that we're investing in our communities. 43% of all workers in New York City are foreign born. 43%, 50% of small businesses are immigrant-owned as well. So we need to make sure that we are ensuring that the safety and security of all these folks is protected by the city of New York.
We just have 30 seconds, but we wanted to ask you about this Chinese father and son, six-year-old son, the father named Fei, the six-year-old named Yuan Xuan, who were picked up by ICE, the father sent to an ICE jail, the son, the six-year-old, no one knows where he is.
The father is currently in Orange County in detention. The son is in OR custody, which means that's where normally children who are unaccompanied, which is not the situation with this family. The Trump administration is continuing their family separation agenda, and we need to fight back against that as well.
Murad Awalda, thanks so much for clarifying that. President and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, part of Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani's Committee on Immigrant Justice. That does it for our show. Tonight, I'll be in Sag Harbor on the east end of Long Island, where there will be a 7:30 screening of the film Steal This Story, Please, about Democracy Now! It's at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor. I'll be doing the Q&A afterwards with the filmmakers, Teal Lesson and Carl Deal. Check out our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Please enjoy 30 Seconds of Nature, brought to you by Ducks Unlimited Canada. Learn how you can experience nature in your community at ducks.ca.